Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, April 30th. I'm your reader, Dagna, and I'll be reading local Siouxland and Tri-State news. We will begin with the mini editorial, which was written today by Steve Bannis of Sioux City. And Steve writes, "If you have caught up with spring cleaning and gardening chores, I suggest turning in OAN, One American News, to watch their split-screen coverage of the fourth recount in Maricopa County, Arizona. As riveting as watching paint dry and as exciting as a root canal." And this again was written by Steve Bannis of Sioux City. Our first story with the headline is, "More than 100 firefighters gather in Lus Hills to burn grasslands." And this was written by Caitlin Yamada of the Sioux City Journal. Westfield. This week, more than 100 firefighters from Iowa counties, 16 different counties, 10 states, and 3 counties gathered in the Lus Hills to burn over 1,000 acres of grassland. Thick smoke drifted through the area as firefighters worked together to burn patches of land and monitor its progress. For 5 years, the Lus Hills Cooperative Burn Week has provided an opportunity for firefighter training and land stewardship. Monday through Friday, firefighters gathered at the Broken Kettle Grasslands Preserve in Westfield to complete prescribed fire burns on the property. Fire provides ecological advantages to the land that cannot be done with other management tools, said Scott Motes, the Nature Conservancy Director of Stewardship in Iowa and Missouri Fire Manager. Motes said fire is essential to the landscape. He said plants, animals, birds, and insects respond and rely on the impact of the fire. He continued, "Fire is the most compassionate act we can do for ecology, for our landscape." Comparing it to the COVID-19 vaccine, Motes said essential for the animal's survival. It sets back woody vegetation, stimulates flowering, and creates habitat. Every few years, there is a different area of focus for burns within the Lus Hills. Motes said the burn locations are based on different types of vegetation, animal habitats, and weather conditions. Individuals from places such as Oregon, New Mexico, North Carolina, Ecuador, and Spain travel to the Lus Hills for the training opportunity. Firefighter safety, public safety, landscape protection, practice, and cooperation are all areas of education during the week, said Cody Wohlers, Iowa National Heritage Foundation Lus Hills Land Stewardship Director and Burn Incident Commander. He said, "Fire is a byproduct. Whatever acres we get burned, that's the byproduct of that relationship, of that safety, of that training." Some of those attending are trainees and are partnered with a more experienced member and evaluated throughout the week, Motes said. The 46 different organizations gather to collaborate and share learning and knowledge. As of Thursday, the firefighters burned 1,106 acres in the northern Lus Hills, primarily in Plymouth and Woodbury counties. Wohler said the burns vary in complexity. Some are used as first burn opportunity, and others need many people with skilled knowledge. The biggest challenge during the week is the weather. The wind, the temperature, and humidity are taken into consideration when doing prescribed burns. The firefighters have to consider where fire goes. Our fire practitioners are highly trained. They're highly skilled. They work together. They understand the ecology, Motes said. Wohler said the firefighters have to pay close attention to the fire and make quick decisions whether to let a spot burn or put it out and prevent it from spreading. At the end of the week, Wohler said the firefighters are tired, but they received valuable knowledge and built cooperative relationships with similar organizations. Our next story headline is, "Siouxland Schools React to Biden's Free Community College Plan." This was written by Mason Doctor of the Sioux City Journal. If President Joe Biden's plan to offer 2 free years of community college for all adults comes to pass, it will not be the first time Western Iowa Tech Community College students pay no tuition, but it would be the first time none of the students had to pay tuition. WITCC has been offering free tuition in more than 30 of its 70-plus programs since the fall of 2019. The free programs, funded through the Iowa Department of Education, are in high-demand fields like healthcare, agriculture, computers and IT, construction and trades, health administration, culinary arts, law enforcement, and emergency services and robotics. On the whole, free tuition was a boon for these programs, at least in the sense of enrollment. The number of students tripled in some cases. Still, somewhat more than half of WITS programs charged fees and tuition. A day after Biden laid out his plans to a joint session of Congress, the college struck an optimistic tone in a statement provided by WITCC spokesman Andrea Rolina. Western Isle Tech Community College aims to support our community and train the workforce of Siouxland businesses. We are happy the current administration sees the value of a community college education and its positive impact on our local economy. We support any attempt to increase access to education while decreasing the financial burden on our students. WITCC looks forward to learning more about President Biden's American Families Plan as it unfolds, the college said in a statement. Manoj Patel, president of the Little Priest Tribal College in Winnebago, Nebraska, said Biden's free tuition proposal has left him feeling a bit uneasy. One of Little Priest's main selling points is its inexpensive tuition, calibrated to allow lower-income students on the Winnebago reservation a chance at higher education. If that advantage were pulled out from under them, Patel said, he doesn't know what would become of the college. He said he'd support the plan if the Biden administration would guarantee to channel some funding to schools like his, should they be endangered by declining enrollment. Our students will be more leaning towards going to the other schools if the colleges are free, Patel said. As a college president, I think it's going to impact our bottom line, he added. Indeed, Biden has proposed giving large sums to HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, and TCUs as a part of his initiative. Michael Oltreg, president of the Nebraska Indian Community College, said Thursday that he wasn't entirely sure what impact free two-year tuition would have at NICC. Like Little Priest, NICC students generally don't graduate with much debt as it is. Next year, he's hoping to make the college essentially tuition-free using COVID relief funds. We are the greatest country in the world. We certainly have the responsibility to be doing things like that, he said. I don't know for sure how it will work exactly or if it's going to be a big deficit to my institution. Northeast Community College President Leah Barrett said in a statement Thursday that she doesn't know how 2 free years of community college would turn out for the Norfolk-based college, which also has a campus in South Sioux City. Regardless, Barrett said she's in favor of making college accessible. Each state is unique in how it supports community colleges, Barrett said in a statement. Improving access to higher education for people in our region is a priority to address workforce needs throughout our 20-county service area. How free community college plays out in Nebraska, Iowa, and South Dakota will look different. Lamar's reveals its RAGBRAI theme and logo. The city of Lamar's is kicking off RAGBRAI this year with a theme that combines ice cream and cycling. The Lamar's RAGBRAI committee said in a statement Thursday that its plans include paying homage to the city's position as the ice cream capital of the world with the logo and theme Lamar's a la Road. The community will welcome 20,000 riders and spectators in the days ahead of RAGBRAI's official July 25th start date. Lamar's is excited to kick off RAGBRAI this year. There are many moving pieces to coordinate an event of this magnitude, and the entire committee of volunteers is working hard to coordinate bike and shuttle routes, identify and promote public safety needs and opportunities, arrange and organize entertainment, fundraise, and recruit and place nearly 400 volunteers. Peggy Stitzman, executive chair, said in a statement. She continues, there will be an opportunity for groups and people of all ages to help and benefit from RAGBRAI. We are all working hard to make it one of the best and safest events in this community that they have seen for years. Riders, spectators, and locals will find a wide variety of food, shopping, and entertainment in downtown Lamar's beginning July 23rd through the 24th. The statement said food and vendor applications are now being accepted. In lieu of RAGBRAI-sponsored housing this year, local residents and riders are encouraged to visit the RAGBRAI Lamar's Housing Camping Connection Group on Facebook to arrange lodging. Lamar's residents and riders can connect in the forum to understand and agree to the COVID-19 mitigation needs of both parties, according to the statement. Winnebago murder trial continued. The trial for a Winnebago, Nebraska man charged with killing his fiancée on the Winnebago Indian Reservation has been continued. Jonathan Rooney had been scheduled to go to trial May 10th in U.S. District Court in Omaha on charges of second-degree murder and tampering with documents or proceedings in Indian country. U.S. Magistrate Judge Michael Nelson on Tuesday granted a defense request to continue the trial and reschedule it for August 16th. Rooney's attorney, Assistant Federal Public Defender Kelly Steenbach, sent in her request that additional time was needed to negotiate a resolution short of trial. She said the additional time could help her and prosecutors resolve the case. The U.S. Attorney's Office did not resist Steenbach's motion. Rooney, 26, is accused of killing 22-year-old Cozy Decora of Winnebago and burning her body on May 16th at a remote cabin near Winnebago, and destroying a cell phone and his clothing with the intent to hinder the investigation. Officers responding to a call from Decora, who told them that she, Rooney, and their infant son had gotten stuck on a muddy road, found the woman's remains in a fire near the cabin. Rooney was found sleeping naked in the cabin with his four-month-old son, court documents said. Rooney told authorities the two had gotten into an argument. Decora hit him with something, and he pushed her out of the cabin, shut the door, and laid down on the mattress. The next thing he was aware of, he said, the officers were waking him up. An autopsy could not determine if there was trauma to Decora's body before it was burned. Her remains were identified using dental records. Rooney was initially charged with manslaughter in June, but a second superseding indictment filed in October charged him with second-degree murder. He could face a prison sentence ranging from 14 years to life if he pleads guilty to or is convicted of second-degree murder. Yankton and Union counties report COVID-19-related deaths. Two more COVID-19-related deaths were reported in southeast South Dakota counties on Thursday. Yankton and Union counties each recorded a death, bringing their totals to 30 and 42 respectively. Yankton County's COVID-19 case total stood at 3,069 on Thursday, while Union County had 2,212 total cases. No other Siouxland counties reported new deaths as of Thursday afternoon. Woodbury County added 12 new cases of the virus, bringing its case total to 15,032, according to a statement from Siouxland District Health Department. The Northwest Iowa County's 14-day positivity rate on tests was 3.8%. Health officials have said anything above 5% is a concern. District Health reported that 9 patients were hospitalized Thursday at either Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center or Unity Point Health St. Luke's, which was down 1 from Wednesday. Of those patients, 5 were hospitalized for treatment of COVID-19. 4 other people in the hospital had the virus, but were hospitalized for other reasons. Of the total, 5 were Woodbury County residents. District Health said in a social media post that more than 1,400 second doses of COVID-19 vaccines were set to be administered Thursday at the Siouxland Expo Center. As of Thursday afternoon, 27,045 people in Woodbury County had received both shots of a second of the two-dose vaccine, while another 2,991 had received a single-dose vaccine, according to the state statistics. That's just over 29% of the county's population. And our next story headline is Workers Who Died in 2020 Memorialized, Sioux City. 51 workers in Iowa died at work or as a result of workplace accidents in 2020, according to statistics compiled by the Western Iowa Labor Federation. 2 were as young as 19. More than a dozen were in their 20s and 30s. The oldest was 79. Many of them had families. Some died in vehicle accidents, construction accidents, farming accidents, or equipment accidents. Some were electrocuted, and at least 10 died of COVID-19. They were memorialized in a Workers' Memorial Day ceremony Wednesday evening at the United Food and Commercial Workers Union Local 222 offices on Lakeport Street. The services were held on the 50th anniversary of the establishment of OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. John Hamm, a retired member of the local 33 Plumbers and Steam Fitters Union, read the names of all 51 workers, while Harlan Curley Salvatore, a fellow Local 33 retiree, rang a bell in their honor. A set of battery-powered candles were illuminated. Sister Shirley Fenneran said a prayer. We are all remembering people that have died on the job or as a result of their jobs. These candles over here represent 51 people that were here last year that are not here with us this year. People should not have to die to make a living to support their families. That's all there is to it, Hamm said in a somber, mournful tone. The number of Iowa workers who died in their line of work last year exceeded the numbers of recent years. There were 32 worker deaths in 2018, 34 in 2017, and 39 in 2016. Buena Vista County, where two Tyson Foods plants are the largest employers, suffered more worker deaths last year than any other county in Iowa. Meat plants have been implicated in the serious outbreak of the virus last spring. The official number of Iowa workers who died of COVID-19 contracted on the job last year, 10, is based on figures from employers who acknowledged these deaths. Jeff Shudak, president of the Western Iowa Labor Federation, told the Journal Wednesday evening that there's reason to think the true number is much higher. But, he noted, it's almost impossible to prove. It certainly seems underreported, he said. At a single Tyson plant in Waterloo, more than 1,000 workers were infected with the virus. A plant manager there is alleged to have organized a betting pool to predict how many of those workers would contract the virus. Dennis McElwain, a Sioux City attorney who has worked with labor unions, echoed Shudak's stance on the official numbers during his address at the services. We know that the numbers have to be far higher than that. Police investigating shooting deaths. Sioux City police are treating the shooting death of a man and a woman in Morningside residence as a homicide. At around 9:24 Thursday, Sioux City police officers were called to a residence in the 2500 block of South Mulberry Street in Sioux City, where a person had been found dead, according to a press release from the police department. Inside, officers discovered two bodies, dead of apparent gunshot wounds. The names of the deceased have been withheld pending notification of the family. Police detectives believe they have identified all parties involved in the incident, according to the press release, and are not seeking any other suspects. 8-year-old dies in farm accident, climbing hill. An 8-year-old child died Tuesday as a result of a farming accident in Woodbury County. Woodbury County Sheriff's Department and Emergency Medical Services responded to a call of an accident at 4:54 p.m., approximately 4 miles east of Climbing Hill. In a news release, Woodbury County Sheriff Chad Sheehan said no additional details would be released at this time. Man with stolen gun gets prison, Sioux City. A South Dakota man found in possession of a stolen handgun near a Sioux City elementary school has been sentenced to 10 years in prison. Timothy Ellenson, 28, of Sioux Falls, pleaded guilty in Woodbury County District Court to felon in possession of a firearm, second-degree theft, tampering with records, and 2 counts of third-degree burglary. As part of a plea agreement, charges of carrying a weapon on school grounds, falsifying public documents, and 2 counts of third-degree burglary were dismissed. Allenson was arrested March 23rd after he was found sleeping near a Leeds Elementary school door and asked by school staff to leave. Police located Ellison nearby and found him in possession of a loaded 9mm handgun, which was believed to have been stolen from a pickup truck parked in the 2900 block of Chambers Street. Ellison also was charged with breaking into vehicles at 2300 Indian Hills Drive and at 29th and Virginia Streets and stealing items from them. Ellison had no identification with him when he was arrested and told police his name was Kevin Bice. We'll now move to the opinion page, and we have an editorial from the Lincoln Journal Star, which is headlined, Stop Throwing Money at Nebraska's Tax Problem. Nearly 15 cents out of every dollar in the 2-year state budget Governor Pete Ricketts signed into law on Monday has been directed to property tax relief, an achievement the governor celebrated. Let that eye-opening figure, 15%, or $1.45 billion of the $9.7 billion budget, sink in for a moment. Nebraska's property tax rate remains among the highest in the nation, yet the governor and several state lawmakers support only incremental solutions that bring in no new revenue and solve little, such as a bill that failed to advance late last week that would have capped the annual increases local government boards could request. The ever-present problem of reducing the burden property taxes place on Nebraskans, particularly those who own large swaths of farmland, wasn't going to be solved with this one piece of legislation. It will take a significant study and comprehensive compromise that cannot be achieved in this late in the legislative session. The 3% annual figure, or 9% over 3 years, plus real growth in the now defeated bill, was an entirely arbitrary, artificial number. As such, it would represent an entirely arbitrary, artificial handcuff and loss of local control for school districts, cities, counties, and other taxing authorities in responding to unpredictable changes. And it marks another step that avoids the comprehensive reform Nebraskans so desperately need. How to line up rent aid and a backup plan. Rather than rebalancing the three-legged stool of property, income, and sales tax, with explosive growth in property taxes leaving the entire structure wobbly, the legislature keeps proposing incremental fixes and increasing the amount of money dedicated to property tax relief. This intractable problem comes down to the fact that between only a quarter and a third of Nebraska school districts, depending on the year, receive any direct state aid, and property taxes are the lone local tool they have to fulfill the constitutional duty of universal education for children between the ages of 5 and 19, which can be a volatile and pricey proposition. In the end, proponents' argument of trust us to improve the tax bill after we advance it convinced few, if any, senators following years of the same old song and dance. That being said, U.S. Senator Deb Fischer, a former state senator, was correct in breaking her silence on the legislature's vote, noting that we stood up and we took a stand. The hours are long, the pay is abysmal, the criticism can be withering, but senators were elected to make tough decisions, to vote either yes or no, rather than take no action, which has the same effect as voting no. This is an increasingly common method to kill legislation. Perhaps no decision before them will have as widespread positive impact as tax reform that guarantees adequate state funding for K-12 schools while easing and more equitably distributing the property tax burden. We'll now move to the sports section, and we'll have some stories on the NAIA women's volleyball championship games that's being played in Sioux City. On our first one, Dort Jamestown women's volleyball win national quarterfinal matches. When the matches were over on Thursday in the early session of the NAIA women's volleyball quarterfinals, both Jamestown and Dort let out a loud chant of GPAC. Both teams had won and were moving on to Friday's semifinals. The defenders defeated GPAC foe Concordia, while Jamestown went through Eastern Oregon, both matches in three sets. The defenders won their match by set scores 25-23, 25-18, and 25-21, while the Jimmies swept Eastern Oregon 25-22, 25-20, and 25-21. Each game, Chad Hansen can see the defenders' spirit growing through each set. The defenders used that spirit and trust to help sweep the Bulldogs. "We just played together," said Dort's Allison Timmermans. "We stayed disciplined, we trusted each other, and it just showed. It is very important, regardless of how the season outcome was. We still have room to grow, and we have opportunities to do that again." Hansen isn't afraid of substituting different girls in the rotation, and he rotates players into the strengths depending on said rotation. "What a different defender enters the match, that forces the defenders to adjust by which player is coming into the match. That creates a new relationship that wasn't necessarily there in the previous rallies." Hansen has seen the accountability, the openness, and the vulnerability increase throughout the games. "The defenders have been learning that dynamic throughout the season. They're figuring out each other's strengths, weaknesses, and other values." Hansen said, "For us to get more familiar and confident in that rotation, there's so many mix of components that our players are just feeling very comfortable. More than that, there's a spirit on our team that's really deep that we share in Christ that is allowing us to be more free through the pressure. He added, we might be doubting something on the court, but for a teammate to come up and embrace and tell her, I believe in you, that breeds so much peace of mind to the teammate. We are learning at an accelerated rate that level of trust. We can increase the high level producing moments. They're able to problem solve on their own. Dort played every rally like it was in crunch time, and they had to climb out of a hole early in the first set. The Bulldogs led 17-12 in the first set, and the Bulldogs went up 5 points following a block from Gabby Nordacker. Hansen called timeout, and that's when the defenders took a deep breath, and you guessed it, they relied on trusting each other. Dort caught up with Concordia at 23-23 all, and that happened on a Brenna Kromedic block. Kromedic then had a kill where she found a hole in the middle of the Bulldogs' defense, and the set ended with a service ace from Erica Boozman. Dort had a lead as many as 7 in the second set, and that was due in large part to Concordia errors. Concordia committed 9 errors in the set and hit just .023 in the second set. In the third set, Concordia's hitting average jumped to a .235, but the defenders hit .306 to close out the set. The defenders led 23-16 late in the set, and there were 2 kills there late in the set from Jessie DeJager and Corina Timmermans. The defenders had 15 kills in the first and third sets while having 10 in set number 2. The Timmermans sisters led the defenders with kills. Allison had 11, Corina 10. Megan Rasler had 24 assists, and Hannah Connolly had 18 digs. Kromedic had 3 solo blocks and 5 assisted blocks. Jory Bronner had a solo block and 2 solo blocks. Brenna is just a key go-to, dependable, but she'll produce points, Hansen said. Back in August, if you had told Hansen that the defenders would be a national semifinalist, he would not have necessarily believed you. Hansen said, this is really, really huge. For us to have been in this moment back in 2017 was just incredible. Life-forming experiences for athletes to play at that high level, Hansen said. The key is just to keep our feet on the ground. And now we move on to the Jamestown games. The Jimmies had 2 hitters who scored in double figures. Taylor Sabanish led with 12 kills, while Kaylee Hergely had 10. The Jimmies hit .292 as a team and recorded 47 total kills. Megan Gaffney led in assists with 21, while Jackie Michaeljohn had 19. 5 different Jimmies had double-digit digs. Sydney Ellingson had 16, Michaeljohn had 18, and 2 others had 10. To see the recaps from the later quarterfinals, go to online to SiouxCityJournal.com. We now have a sports article by Zach James, and the headline is GPAC Showcases Top Volleyball Football Programs in Town This Week. If you didn't know, the Great Plains Athletic Conference, or GPAC, was a solid conference among collegiate sports, this week should serve as a pretty good reminder. The GPAC is in the limelight this week, as 5 programs were among the 8 in the Women's Volleyball National Quarterfinals. Then on Saturday, Morningside and Northwestern will meet for a spot in the NAIA Football National Championship. The 5 teams that qualified for the National Volleyballs Tournament were Northwestern, Dort, Midland, Concordia, and Jamestown. All 5 teams are ranked, too. In the final poll released on April 12th, Jamestown held the number 1 spot. The Jimmies entered the tournament with a 25-1 record, and they've shown every bit that they're the top-ranked team in the country. The Jimmies opened up pool play by coming back to beat a good Viterbo team. Then the Jimmies swept Providence on Wednesday. Northwestern was ranked 5th and had a 19-4 record before the tournament started on Tuesday. Northwestern played in 5 sets against Oklahoma City, where the Red Raiders were down 2-1. They came back, beating the Stars with a 15-6 fifth set. Midland coach Paul Gieselman lauded Northwestern coach Kyle Vanderbosch for the success he's had while in Orange City. Gieselman said, Kyle is a terrific coach, and I coached against his dad way back in the day. If that's who we play, which turned out to be true, that's going to be a lot of fun for the student athletes and the fans. The Bulldogs came in ranked 10th and held a 12-4 record before Thursday's quarterfinal match against the Defenders. Speaking of the Defenders, they were ranked 16th in that final April 12th poll, winning 14 matches before winning two more in Sioux City this week. Hastings also received votes this season. As the five GPAC teams clinched spots in the volleyball quarterfinals on Wednesday, three of the programs lauded the others and how good they were, and how fortunate it was to play in a competitive conference like the GPAC. For example, Northwestern senior Emily Van Ginkle said that playing against good GPAC teams helped them play in a match like the one they did against Oklahoma. "I think it shows that we have some really good competition in the conference, and that's a credit to why we succeed as well," Van Ginkle said. "We get some good quality competition year-round." Four of the five GPAC teams played one another. Dorton Concordia met in a 5 p.m. quarterfinal, while the Red Raiders played the Warriors in a nightcap. That match ended up after the Journal's press deadline. Geiselman, in his 11th year, said the national tournament shows just how good the conference is, just by the team's quality of play. Geiselman said, "I think we've had a team in the Final Four for the last five straight years, and we've been there twice. We have some players on this team that were on our last Final Four team. The moment wasn't too big for us. Our mental toughness is a big difference. We haven't gotten rattled against Indiana Wesleyan." The five teams got here through the tournament in the middle of a pandemic. The Defenders are one of the teams who haven't taken that success lightly. "It really is a privilege to be competing at the final site, to be one of the 24 teams, and the 24 teams have each other had to work through COVID," Dort coach Chad Hansen said. "I'm sure each team has been impacted by it one way or the other. Every single one of us has been impacted in a hard way. To have the NAIA be able to run a classy event and a quality event, it's really incredible and a privilege." And then the GPAC football showcase. On Saturday, for the second time this season, the Red Raiders football team comes to Elwood Olsen Stadium to face number one Morningside. The two programs met up to start the football season, and even though the Mustangs won the game 45-31, the Mustangs scored 21 straight points in the fourth quarter to hold off their opponents. Northwestern gave Morningside's defense everything it had, as quarterback Tyson Quima threw for 447 yards and reached the century mark in rushing that night, too. He did all that while battling cramps during the fourth quarter on a warm September night. This time around, it will be a warm, sunny April afternoon, and the winner will go to the national championship game. That NAIA National Championship game is Monday, May 10th in Gambling, Louisiana. The Mustangs are the two-time defending national champions, while the Red Raiders are in a semifinal contest for the first time since 2000. Red Raiders coach Matt McCarty was a freshman on that team. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, April 30th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now turn to today's obituaries and death notices. Robert D. Bob McCracken, Onawa, Iowa, 89, died Sunday, April 25th. Services will be May 7th at 10 a.m. at the Rush Family Chapel in Onawa. Masks will be required. The burial will be at Little Sioux Cemetery in Little Sioux, Iowa. Visitation will be May 6th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home. Arrangements with Rush Family Care Service, Onawa. Rosalie M. Ivaner, Sioux City, 74, died Wednesday, April 28th. Services will be held at a later date. Arrangements with Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Carol Krosh, and that's spelled K-R-O-K-S-H, Akron, Iowa, 88, died Wednesday, April 28th. Services will be May 3rd at 11 a.m. at the Adaville United Methodist Church in Merrill. Private family burial will be at the Pleasant Valley Cemetery in Merrill. Visitation will be May 2nd from 3 to 7 p.m. Wex Winkle Funeral Home in Akron, and resume 1 hour prior to service time at the church. Masks and social distancing requested. Services available to stream afterwards on the funeral home's website. James Mandocino, Jr., 78, of Sioux City, passed away Thursday, April 22nd at a local hospital after a lengthy illness surrounded by his entire family. Service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Monday at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel with Pastor Scott Eggers officiating. Visitation will be from 2 to 4 p.m. on Sunday at the funeral home. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. Online condolences may be made at meyerbroschapels.com. James was born on June 14, 1942, in Sioux City to James Sr. and Alma Hindman Mendocino. He was raised in Sioux City. He attended Lowell Elementary School and Leeds Junior and Senior High School, graduating in 1961. He was a machinist at Sioux City Journal, pipe fitter, welder for numerous companies, and Mid-American. He retired from Lamar's Meter Shop. James met the love of his life at the age of 15 and married Diane Newton on June 23, 1963 at Trinity Lutheran Church in Sioux City. They were married for 57 years. To this union, they had four children. He was a devoted husband, father, grandfather, and great-grandfather. James was a great friend to many. He enjoyed working on all types of cars, bikes, motorcycles, and anything that needed fixed. He enjoyed his 1940 Ford, his red convertible Corvette, watching old westerns, and going to coffee with his morning group. He belonged to the Stroller Car Club, Tri-State Cruisers, and the Hawkeye Rifle and Pistol Club. His family was most important to him. He loved visits with his children and grandchildren, playing cards with his sisters, and visiting with his best friends. You all know who you are. James was baptized a Methodist and truly believed in the Lord. A special thank you to Dr. Paul Peterson, Mayo Clinic, and ICU nurses at Unity Point Health for taking such great care of Jim. We'll do one more sports story, and this is for college softball. The Briarcliff University softball team picked up a pair of non-conference wins against Dakota State Wednesday afternoon at the Bishop Mueller Field. The Chargers moved to 22-22 on the season. A four-run sixth inning for the Cliff in Game 1 was the difference in the 6-2 BCU win. Sammy McDonald pinch hit for Josie Cronick in the sixth frame and did her job, driving in Rochelle Heaton with a single for the game-winning run. Allie Poston also served as a pinch hitter in the sixth and doubled to center field to score insurance runs from Cronick and Colleen Billings. Kylie Lukes was responsible for the Chargers' final run, doubling to right to plate Poston. Lukes and Aubrey Chikchura tallied the team's other two RBIs, both in the first inning. Maley Jensen was the winning pitcher in Game 1, giving up two hits and striking out one in 2.2 innings of work. Billings, Lukes, and Brooke Massey had two hits each. McDonald drove in the first two runs of Game 2, with a two-run home run to left center, scoring pinch runner Lauren Corey. After giving up two runs in the top of the third, the Chargers answered with four runs in the bottom of the inning to take a 6-2 lead. With the bases loaded, Aubrey Chikura doubled to deep right center, scoring Alexis Westerkamp, Hunter Pitts, and Poston. McDonald drove in a final insurance run in the fourth inning, scoring Billings with a single to the left field. McKenna Raby gets the win for the Cliff after closing out the final four and a third innings out of the bullpen. Raby struck out four, gave up three hits, and allowed just one run. McDonald went 2-for-2 from the plate, scored one run, and had three RBIs. Chikura drove in the three RBIs and scored one run. Dort, 11-8, Waldorf, 3-0. The defenders responded with a high-scoring output in the bottom of the fourth of Game 1, scoring 10 runs on 9 hits. Chandler Shepard led off and was hit by a pitch, and the next two batters reached to load the bases. Aaron Bredemus had the first RBI of the inning on a single to the middle infield, following Brooklyn Van Oort's RBI single to make the score 3-2. Kayla Zevenbergen doubled, driving in three runs. Rachel Evafold was in her second at-bat of the inning, hitting a two RBI double. The final two runs of the inning came on Hannah Sikkema's double to left center field that scored Shemper and Evafield. In Game 2, added runs in the fourth, with Kenzie Cunard hitting a sacrifice fly to score Ivy Terpstra for the first run of the inning. Later, with two runners on base, Eva Fold singled to center field, allowing Jessica Flattery and Carly Olson to cross home plate. With two outs, Herringa doubled to bring in Shepherd and Everfield and giving Dort an 8-0 lead. I'll now read the column by Kathy Yoder, which is a weekly column on Fridays. And it's headlined, Perspective Helps Us Understand Life's Changes. And we're opening with a verse from Psalm 139, verses 1 through 4. You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. And then Kathy Yoder writes, Perspective is a funny thing. While we're standing inside a building, it's hard to see the whole structure. We see the room we are in. We easily look around and identify walls, a floor, and whatever else we notice inside the room. If there's a window, we look and see what's on the outside, or we see what's outside the window. We might look a little further, but it's true that we mostly see what's directly in front of us. Sometimes we think to turn around and look back, but not always. We have to go outside the building to truly see it. To gain perspective, we have to walk away. And yet, while we're on the outside looking in, we don't see what's on the inside. It takes hard work to know a building from the inside out and the outside in. To know how it functions, its little quirks, the sounds that are normal to this one building, the squeaks, the groans, the sighs. It's the same with our lives. To gain perspective, we have to take a step back. If we're rushing from one event to another, we don't have time to look around or to reflect. How can we be thankful when we're constantly running? How can we know that our lives are three-dimensional when we're living them as if they're barely one dimension? Sometimes life's events force us to stop. All of a sudden, we go from 1,000 miles an hour to standing still. Usually it's not a good event that causes us to come to a full stop. We lose a job. A loved one receives a bad diagnosis. A marriage ends. There's a worldwide pandemic. A family member dies. We can all fill in the blanks. We can travel back in time to years ago and remember. Some can travel back to yesterday or even today. When I stop and gain perspective on this one life I have on earth, I'm amazed. God's loving and He's faithful. He's always been faithful, and He always will be. Psalm 36:5 states, Your steadfast love, O Lord, extends to the heavens, your faithfulness to the clouds. The Lord has never changed. He never will. In a world that seems to be constantly changing, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and today and forever. From Hebrews 13:8. That comforts me. That makes all the difference. I stand with Him. I build my life on Him. When life takes sharp turns and threatens to harm me, I turn to Him, Abba Father, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the Ancient of Days, my Redeemer and my Savior, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world, the one who died on the cross very personally for me. The God of the universe knows me, not in some vague, stand in line and be counted way. No, in a personal, He created me and knows me from the inside out and the outside in way. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. This is from Psalm 139:13-16. With the perspective comes the realization that the Lord knows me and loves me with an everlasting love. All my life, He's been faithful. Even when I wasn't faithful to Him, He was still faithful to me. Not only has He been faithful, but He has pursued me. He's not given up or abandoned me like an old farmhouse that no one wants. It sits in a place where once there was life, but the life's gone. The building's empty. It just doesn't realize it. So it continues to stand, a shell of its former self. No family lives there, no laughter, no love, no tears. Just the existence until one day it begins to fall. And the building slowly realizes something that's been true for a long time. It's dying. Don't be like the abandoned farmhouse. Let the Lord breathe fresh life into you. Let him take up residence in your heart. We cannot fathom the perspective he has on each one of us. He created us. He knows us from the inside out. He knows every day, every moment that we live on this earth. And again from Psalm, continuing from where we left off in Psalm 139, verse 16. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you. He knows us. He loves us. He is faithful to us. And then finish with Lamentations 3. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I will hope in him. And Kathy Yoder is a devotional writer, and you may reach her at kathyyoder4@gmail.com. We'll now move to the health and family section of the paper of the Sioux City Journal. And our first one, article I'm going to read is about location of excess body fat. And it's a question, and this is written by Howard Lewine, who is an MD from Harvard. And the question was, why does it matter where your body stores fat in terms of overall health? And the answer, no matter your body shape, excess fat isn't good for your health. But saddlebags and ballooning bellies are not equivalent. When it comes to body fat, location counts. The fat deep within the abdomen is more perilous than the fat you can pinch with your fingers. Most body fat is subcutaneous, the kind that lies in a layer just beneath the skin. Other fat lies out of reach beneath the abdominal wall. It's found in the spaces surrounding the liver, intestines, and other organs. As this intra-abdominal fat accumulates, it expands belly size, creating an apple-shaped body. Although visceral fat makes up only a small proportion of a body fat, it's a key player in a variety of health problems. Visceral fat is highly inflammatory and metabolically disruptive. It releases inflammatory molecules that contribute to insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, and ultimately cardiovascular disease. In contrast, fat located at the hips and thighs is associated with better metabolic health, including lower total cholesterol, LDL, bad cholesterol, and triglyceride levels. People with this so-called pear-shaped body also are less likely to develop diabetes, high blood pressure, and heart disease. Visceral fat is most accurately measured with imaging, such as a CT scan or MRI, but that's not practical and also expensive. Research shows that properly done waist measurements correlate well with the amount of belly fat seen on imaging. A tape measure is all you need to keep tabs on visceral fat. Measure your waistline at the level of the navel, not at the narrowest part of the torso, and always measure in the same place. Don't suck in your gut or pull the tape tight enough to compress the area. Ideally, your waist side should be about one half of your weight. But rather than focus on a single reading, track changes in your waist size over time to see if you are gaining or losing visceral fat. Where on your body you tend to gain fat depends on your genes, your age, and your birth weight. Smaller babies more readily add belly fat later in life. You can't change your birth weight or your genes, but you can minimize the accumulation of visceral fat. Eat more lean protein, fruits, vegetables, and whole grains, and reduce processed carbohydrates, especially added sugars. Stay physically active throughout the day. Commit to some form of aerobic exercise every day, and do resistance weight training 2 to 3 times a week. Get adequate, restful sleep. Most adults, that means 7 to 8 hours per night. And limit stress, as it is correlated with the release of the hormone cortisol, which is linked to abdominal weight gain. And our next article is about fiber. As part of a healthy diet, fiber is a nutrient most associated with keeping the digestive tract regular, and thanks to the marketing on the oatmeal container, lowering cholesterol. But fiber's role in the body goes way beyond regularity, and one of fiber's most important roles stems from the influence that gut health has on heart health. To put it simply, a healthier gut means a healthier heart. According to research, a healthy gut has a protective effect on the heart by influencing factors that cause and contribute to heart disease. Check out these four ways that eating fiber protects your heart. The first way, it lowers cholesterol in multiple ways. Foods with soluble fiber, such as oats, have demonstrated ability to lower levels of LDL cholesterol, the type of cholesterol we want less of, when eaten consistently and regularly. Soluble fiber adds to bile, a cholesterol-based compound that assists in digesting fats, and both the fiber and bile are later excreted. The body then uses circulating lipids to form new bile molecules, lowering total and LDL cholesterol. Number two, it lowers blood pressure. Fiber cannot be digested, but good bacteria in the gut can ferment some fibers in the colon. The fermentation process produces short-chain fatty acids. These provide energy and nutrients for the bacteria, and research suggests that the short-chain fatty acids production can also lower blood pressure. In fact, eating a high-fiber diet is even considered a treatment for hypertension by some health professionals, since increasing fiber intake is the best way to increase short-chain fatty acids. And number three, it prevents inflammation. Gut health plays a key role in the inflammatory process. The mechanism works this way. A healthy gut creates a protective barrier in the intestines, allowing nutrients to pass into the bloodstream while blocking out many inflammatory compounds in food. While these good bacteria are disrupted or become unbalanced, this barrier isn't as effective and starts to leak, allowing those compounds into the body. Because most chronic conditions are driven by inflammation, promoting gut health with a healthy, fiber-rich diet is key for preventing heart disease, as well as a host of other lifestyle-related conditions. And number four, helps you lose belly fat, which our article before talked about. Consuming a high-fiber diet is associated with less abdominal fat. This is important since people who carry extra weight in the abdominal area are at a higher risk for developing heart disease. Increasing daily fiber can help with the weight loss by slowing down the digestive process to provide a feeling of fullness and satiety. I'm not sure how to say that word. It can also increase the number and diversity of good bacteria to reduce inflammation, which is also now considered an underlying driver of obesity. We'll now move to Dear Abby. Our first letter is, Dear Abby, I am a 48-year-old woman divorced for 10 years. During that time, I have been in two serious relationships. I'm no prude, but it seems like everyone I date and who my friends and I talk to and articles I see are all about sex, having sex, rushing to sex. It's like there's no emphasis on actually getting to know a person. I'd like to believe that sex is something people who are already emotionally intimate can share. But by the third day, sex is not only expected, but considered normal. When I say that it's too soon for me, I'm not called back for another date. If I do go forward with sex, I feel compromised and cheapened when the relationship ends. These men didn't take the time to actually know me. Please understand, I'm mature enough to handle this, but I'm deterred from dating because of it. Are there any men out there who want a connection that isn't just physical? Signed, Not Connecting in Missouri. And Abby responds, Dear Not Connecting, yes, there are, but in our hookup culture, it may take time to find them. I agree that we live in a sex-obsessed society where we are constantly reminded in print, television, film, and online media. Many men in your age group avoid emotional intimacy because they have been divorced and don't want to quickly jump back into a committed relationship. It's possible you might have better luck if you join activity groups in which the members have common interests besides running right off to the bedroom. You should never allow yourself to be coerced into doing anything you don't feel ready for. Unlike what some people may believe, sex does not automatically go with the dinner. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, April 30th. I'm your reader, Dagna, and you can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you so much for listening.